Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for January 25th, 2008. This week, we'll talk about the latest in space research, and then we will segue seamlessly into stories about animal adaptations. There's something for everybody today, starting with space. Suzanne, I understand you've been learning about weather in space.
That's right. Of course, you know about the National Weather Service.
Mm-hmm.
But did you know the government also runs another weather service called the Space Weather Prediction Center?
Space weather, no. But let me guess, does it have something to do with space tourism? You know, check ahead before you go into orbit? Otherwise, you're going to be saying, man, I spent nearly $1 million on this trip and, you know, we had nothing but meteor showers like the whole time.
No, not exactly. The Space Weather Prediction Center actually keeps track of solar storms.
Oh.
And earlier this month, they spotted the first sunspot of the new 11-year solar storm cycle. That's when violent storms spew magnetic particles into space, many of them reaching Earth.
That sounds bad, but I mean, it can't be too bad if it's been happening every 11 years. It can't be anything like apocalyptic.
No, but the storms can disrupt satellite data, phone service, and even the electrical grid. And we rely more on satellites now than we did 11 years ago. So there is some cause for concern. Not only that, but the first solar storm started a little earlier than predicted, and that usually means the cycle will be a violent one.
Okay, we may have listeners who would like to keep tabs on the latest space weather. Where can they find more information?
They can get up-to-date space weather reports at www.swpc.noaa.gov/SWN. Got that?
Yes, but we can also, just in case people did miss it, we can put a link up on our easy-to-remember website, scienceupdate.com. Thanks, Suzanne. In other space news, the Messenger spacecraft recently sped by the surface of the planet Mercury. It sent back the first close-up photos of the planet taken in the past 30 years, and these have confirmed that the planet is indeed the homeliest of all the planets in the entire solar system. I mean, it's got no moons, no rings, no atmosphere. It does have craters, and it's possible there may be ice at the poles, which would be crazy because it's so close to the sun. But Mercury is not going to be winning any beauty contests.
So why are we going to all the trouble to visit it? Why don't we just go to all the glamorous, colorful planets?
Good question. But beauty, as all the planetary geologists point out, is only crust deep.
Uh-huh.
And underneath that boring exterior is a planet filled with mystery and intrigue. For instance, Mercury has a magnetic field, just as Earth does, and just as Venus and Mars don't. So what about Mercury gives it that feature? Also, more than half of Mercury has never been seen. The craters and other features on that unseen half can give scientists information about the early history of the solar system. Mercury is also twice as dense as Earth, and scientists are going to explore why. And then there are those mysterious reflective patches near the poles. Are they really ice? And that's just the beginning.
It sounds like we may have misjudged poor Mercury.
Indeed. But this Messenger mission has just begun, so we're going to have lots more chances to get to know Mercury. The spacecraft is already sped by the planet and is headed back around the sun and the planet Venus. But it's coming back, taking two more loops around the sun, and that's going to slow Messenger down to the speed of a fighter plane. And that's slow enough for the little planet's gravity to hold the spacecraft in orbit. If you'd like to see the latest photographs taken by Messenger, visit messenger.juapl.edu. Next, our reporter Justin Warner searches the skies for signs of intelligent life, and he's going to tell you how you can, too.
While you're out getting coffee, your PC could be looking for extraterrestrials. You just need to sign up for a project called SETI at Home and download a free screensaver that actually sifts through radio waves from space for signs of alien intelligence. By distributing all that number crunching to hundreds of thousands of computers, the folks at SETI have essentially created the world's most powerful supercomputer. But now, Chief Scientist Dan Wertheimer wants a million more recruits, thanks to a major upgrade in the giant radio telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, that collects the signals.
This thing is a lot more powerful than what we've had before. It has a very good receiver, a very sensitive receiver, much more sensitive than the one we used before, and that's why we're asking more volunteers to help us analyze this data.
The new receiver can also look in seven different places in the sky at once and covers more total sky and more radio bandwidth than ever. As a result, by spring, the researchers expect to be processing 500 times more data than they used to. And while the PCs that are already involved keep getting more and more powerful, Wertheimer says they'll still need a lot more machines to handle all that information. He also notes that filtering out irrelevant Earth-based radio signals is only going to get harder in the future.
This may be a kind of unique time in Earth's history where we can actually do SETI from the ground, because there's more and more radio pollution, and some bands are just completely populated, the television bands, and it's getting worse and worse, and it's getting harder and harder to do SETI from ground-based observatories. Eventually, we may have to do SETI from the backside of the moon or something, where the moon would act as a shield from the Earth's radio pollution. But that would be incredibly expensive. So this may be a unique time in our history where we can actually do these kind of searches.
Thanks for that report, Justin. To sign your computer up for SETI at Home, visit setiathome.berkeley.edu. That's SETIATHOME at Berkeley, BERKELEY.edu. Okay, that's all for space. Now, animals. In case you missed it, by the way, that was our graceful segue. The past few weeks have been full of stories of unusual animal and plant adaptations, and Suzanne has one about blind fish regaining their vision.
Mexican cavefish are completely blind. They live in total darkness and have only rudimentary eyes that don't even sense light. What's more, they've lived in isolation from their sighted relatives on the surface for about 1 million years. But when researchers at New York University bred cavefish from different caves, the surprising result was that many of the offspring not only had eyes, but they could see. Evolutionary biologist Richard Borowski explains that this is probably because each population of cavefish has independently evolved a different set of faulty eye genes.
And so when you hybridize them, the strengths of one cave population make up for the weaknesses of the other cave population in the hybrids, and you get this restoration of function.
He says eyes take a lot of energy to maintain, so in the absence of light, natural selection favored fish with poor eyesight.
Thanks, Suzanne. Alcon blue butterflies are both pretty and extremely sneaky. They actually fool ant colonies into raising their larvae while the ants' own young starve. Scientists have known about this parasitic trickery for years, but now researchers at the University of Copenhagen have pinpointed just how the butterflies get away with it. Chemical signaling is important to ants, and according to evolutionary biologist David Nash, the trick is to produce larvae that smell just like ants.
It will always be better for a parasite if it can better exploit its host, can convert more of its host into its own offspring. The better they mimic their hosts, the faster or the more easily they'll get into the ant colony and be able to parasitize it.
Buddy notes that in places where parasitism by butterflies is high, ants have evolved to smell slightly different from other ants in the same species, suggesting that the butterflies and ants are locked in an evolutionary arms race.
Thanks, Bob. Well, finally today, a story about grandparents. We take the existence of grandparents for granted in human society, but grandparenting behavior hasn't been documented in the animal world until now. Evolutionary biologist David Richardson of the University of East Anglia is part of a team of researchers studying the Seychelles warbler on tiny Kuzan Island in the Indian Ocean. The researchers closely follow the lives of every single bird from birth until death. They've found that older females are often thrown off their territories by their own daughters. But many of them stick around to help feed and raise their grandchildren.
It's a kind of surrogate way of increasing your reproductive success, increasing your genetic output, so to speak.
Richardson says that when the Seychelles warbler nearly went extinct during the last century, there was a nesting spot for every one of the few remaining birds. Back then, this kind of cooperative, intergenerational care was not seen. But now that the species has made a comeback and the island is saturated with nests, some older birds just can't keep their own territories, even though they're still biologically able to breed. So grandparenting is a better option.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll tackle the mystery of the missing helium and learn how forensic geologists are solving diamond-related crimes. Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition. We've got a thrilling new story about science every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website or at iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.